Thank you.
There is so much more to say about this industry and its related trades. So without further ado, let's dive right into some news and trends in this field. As mentioned throughout the program, catalysts are important in boosting production in a whole host of industries. Now, Iranian experts have succeeded in domestically producing two types of catalysts used in the petrochemical sector.
It's a major achievement as the petrochemical industry makes 35 million tons of final products for downstream sectors and exports annually. The National Petrochemical Company says out of 85 types of catalyst used in this industry, 22 of them are domestically made.
Much of Iran's development and expansion of the oil sector is largely owed to its knowledgeable engineers. Such services are also being exported beyond the country's borders. Earlier this year, Iran entered an agreement with Romania to export technical services to the country's gas sector.
Based on the agreement, Iran would provide engineering services to construct gas transmission lines, storage tanks, and other necessary facilities in Romania. Plus, the arrangement seeks to explore joint investment opportunities in various fields, such as the feasibility of building refineries and power plants.
One of the trends we are seeing in the oil and gas sector is the government's determination to expand its developments. One path to achieving this goal is to increase collaboration with knowledge and research-based companies and academic institutions.
The plan for using domestic capacities for innovation in the oil industry has been put at the top of the agenda for years. One example is the massive Memorandum of Understanding, or MOU, signed between the Iranian Oil Innovation and Technology Park with knowledge-based companies. This agreement covers a variety of areas, such as providing capital, developing artificial intelligence, and so much more.
With that, we are fresh out of time. Thank you for tuning in, and I'll see you next time for another edition of Bazaar.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Former Attorney General Eric Holder said on Sunday, 8th of May, that he believes former President Donald J. Trump's actions on 6th of January 2021 and his attempt to overturn the 2020 presidential election probably merit an indictment given what we have learned. The article you're about to hear has been written by Newsweek journalist Jason Lemon. The article has been published by Newsweek magazine and is titled "Trump Indictment for 6th of January Merited, Given What We Have Learned." Former Attorney General Eric Holder said on Sunday, 8th of May, that he believes former President Donald J. Trump's actions on 6th of January 2021 and his attempt to overturn the 2020 presidential election probably merit an indictment, given what we have learned. Hundreds of Trump supporters attacked the U.S. Capitol on 6th of January 2021. In an apparent effort to disrupt the formal certification of President Joe Biden's election win. That attack came after the then-president told his followers to walk to the Capitol and fight like hell to save their country. The assault on the federal legislative branch of the government came after months of Donald Trump lying and spreading misinformation about the 2020 presidential election's outcome. Trump also pressured various officials, in particular Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, to help overturn Joe Biden's election victory. He asked Raffensperger, a Republican, to find enough votes to help flip Georgia in his favor. During an interview with CBS News' Face the Nation program, Eric Holder, who served as the nation's top law enforcement officer under former President Barack Obama, from 2009 to 2015, said he believed an indictment of Donald Trump was likely called for, despite his personal resistance to the idea. I think there's going to be sufficient factual information, and I think that there's going to be sufficient proof of intent. And then the question becomes, what's the impact of such an indictment? I'm an institutionalist. My initial thought was not to indict the former president out of concern of how divisive it would be, the former attorney general explained. But given what we have learned, I think that he probably has to be held to account. Former President Donald Trump has consistently denied any wrongdoing in connection with the Capitol riot or his efforts to overturn the election results. He argues that an investigation into his actions are purely partisan and intended to prevent him from potentially seeking political office in the future. The former president continues to claim that the 2020 presidential election was rigged or stolen, although no evidence has emerged corroborating the allegations. Dozens of election challenge lawsuits brought by the former president and his supporters failed in state and federal courts. Even Trump-appointed judges dismissed the cases. Audits and recounts across the country, including in states where the election was overseen by pro-Trump Republicans, have consistently reaffirmed Joe Biden's election win. Former Attorney General William Barr, who was widely viewed as one of Donald Trump's most loyal cabinet members, has said repeatedly that there is no evidence to support claims of widespread voter fraud being behind Donald Trump's election loss. William Barr wrote in his memoir published in March of this year that he told the former president directly to his face that the claims were simply false. Attorney General Merrick Garland, who was appointed by Joe Biden, has been tight-lipped about the Justice Department's investigation and whether Donald Trump could face an indictment. The Attorney General did give Donald Trump critics hope in a March interview with National Public Radio, NPR, when he said that the Justice Department would pursue action against everyone who committed crimes on 6th of January 2021. We are not avoiding cases that are political or cases that are controversial or cases that are sensitive, Merrick Garland told NPR. What we are avoiding is making decisions on a political basis, on a partisan basis. Continuing, the nation's top law enforcement officer explained, "We begin with the cases that are right in front of us, with the overt actions, and then we build from there. And that is a process that we will continue to build until we hold everyone accountable who committed criminal acts with respect to the 6th of January 2021 riot." Newsweek has reached out to former President Donald Trump's press office for comment.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Europe's largest economy, Germany, is going through a historic phase. Inflation rates have risen sharply, reaching a 40-year high, with soaring energy prices being the key driving force. According to the German Federal Statistics Agency, Destatis, consumer prices were about 7.5% higher in April compared to last year. Berlin also faces an imminent recession in case of a gas supply cut from Russia. The latest remarks by the chief executive officer of a major commercial bank in Germany have increased concerns inside the country. Manfred Knopf has warned that the energy supply in Germany is at risk, which may lead to the spread of bankruptcies in the country. Quoted by a German business newspaper, Knopf said the energy supply is at risk, supply chains are breaking in addition to high inflation in the country. He also warned that bankruptcies in German markets are probably going to increase. According to the executive, almost a third of Germany's foreign trade has been impacted as well. Germany is facing soaring energy prices and a skyrocketing inflation due to the imposition of sanctions on Russia to pressure Moscow into ending the war in Ukraine. The measures mainly affected the financial sector and the supply of high-tech products. The real crisis in Germany lies in the Russian gas, on which it depends to a large extent. Berlin was one of the opponents within the EU to ban the import of Russian gas, but the scenario changed completely after it announced recently its readiness to accept an immediate ban on Russian oil and gas supplies. According to Forbes, Germany is one of the largest customers of Russian oil, and Berlin depends on a third of its Russian oil imports, 45% of its coal purchases, and 55% of its gas imports from Russia. Economists believe the immediate suspension of Russian energy imports would cause a severe recession in Germany.
The EU is not allowed to stop. This is what Washington ordered, and Washington orders the EU around. And the crazy situation right now is that Washington was never as powerful as it is today. This is especially funny since the American president is a weak president. So obviously somebody else is inserting this pressure into the EU from Washington, and I think that is the American deep state pushing Joe Biden and the EU, both of them. And as long as nobody stops this kind of power wielding, it will continue.
The Russia-Ukraine war is not comparable to any other war in history due to its geoeconomic significance. Both Ukraine and Russia are leading exporters of commodities such as crude, natural gas, iron and steel, wheat and edible oils that have a direct impact on inflation levels in major world economies. the conflict pushed crude prices to over $130 per barrel. There were also price increases on wheat, edible oils, and other commodities. The unilateral sanctions of the West against Russia had the unintended consequence of exacerbated inflation in Europe, East Africa, and South Asia, which were the largest importers of Russian wheat and energy. Despite the detrimental effect of sanctions on global markets, the EU unveiled plans for a Russian oil embargo earlier this week. The measure is expected to come into force within 9 months, with the time frame varying for different petroleum products. But several EU nations, including Hungary, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic, are seeking an exemption from the ban.
And of course, all these sanctions against Russia are completely unfair, unjustified, and for the first time, because we have 8th of May today, for the first time since the Second World War, a German government is again siding with Nazis and again against Russia. And this really makes Moscow very angry, and the people too.
The founder of Brazil's Workers' Party, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, who served as president for 2 terms from 2003 to 2011, has launched his presidential bid as Brazil's October 2022 presidential elections approach. Economic recovery is his campaign's main promise.
We need to put Brazil back among the best economies in the world.
In an address to his supporters in the city of São Paulo, Lula called for unity around democracy. He also stressed the importance of focusing on Brazil's sovereignty and environmental issues. He criticized the performance of incumbent president Jair Bolsonaro, calling his administration incompetent. Bolsonaro faces a tough challenge to win re-election against his political nemesis Lula. The latest polls indicate that Lula maintains a comfortable lead over Bolsonaro. Many Brazilians are angry at the president's handling of the coronavirus pandemic, rising inflation, and high fuel prices. Bolsonaro has been widely criticized for downplaying the coronavirus pandemic from the outset, opposing restrictive measures for fear of damaging the economy. Over 650,000 Brazilians have died of COVID-19. Lula had previously described the huge COVID-19 death toll under Bolsonaro's watch as genocide. In addition, the government's fiscal indiscipline and the prospect of double-digit inflation have prompted the central bank to increase interest rates by 5.75 percentage points since March. Now, Lula says if elected, he has grand plans for Brazil's economy. One of them is to free the country of the US dollar. Lula da Silva has proposed expanding Latin American economic integration through the creation of a common regional currency. Lula says Latin American countries should use a unified regional currency like the euro to end South America's inclination toward the US dollar and to do bilateral trade with each other instead of having to exchange for US dollars. Lula has also vowed to revive the BRICS system, integrating Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa in an independent economic architecture to challenge Western financial hegemony. The five countries represent 41% of the global population, 24% of the global gross domestic product, and 16% of the global trade. Lula da Silva has also vowed to bolster Brazil's relations with other regional countries.
Now that's important because still the US dollar is used for the vast majority of trade in Latin America, and internationally still about 70% of international transactions are done with the dollar. What that does is it strengthens the US economy and it weakens other currencies. So Lula da Silva is saying, why are we continuing to do trade with each other using the US government currency? Why don't we create our own currency to do trade with each other? And I think a lot of countries in the region think that's a very sensible policy.
The Bretton Woods Agreement was negotiated in July 1944 by delegates from 44 countries at the United Nations Monetary and Financial Conference held in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire. Under the Bretton Woods system, gold was the basis for the US dollar and other currencies were pegged to the US dollar's value. Since then, the US dollar has dominated global trade and financial market. But now Washington faces a tough challenge, and that's to keep the crown on US dollar's head as the leading global reserve or fiat currency. For many years, the dollar has been the standard currency used in world trade. The U.S. dollar currently has enormous power to infect the global economy with U.S. inflation and the impact of U.S. interest rate rises, both of which are managed primarily for U.S. domestic purposes. Add to it the economic sanctions the U.S. has imposed against other countries to achieve ends that complement or replace military efforts. Venezuela and Cuba are among the Latin American countries that have been victims of the U.S. sanctions regime. One of the consequences of sanctions is rising inflation levels. Hence, it's natural for these economies to seek ways to circumvent America's sanctions. For instance, since 2011, China gradually shifted from trading in U.S. dollars in favor of trade in yuan. It made agreements with Australia, Russia, Japan, Brazil, and Iran to trade in national currencies. It has been reported that in the first quarter of 2020, the share of the dollar in the bilateral trade between China and Russia fell below 50% for the first time.
It's an objective fact that the dollar is becoming less powerful over time. Even the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, which is dominated by the United States, has acknowledged that the use of dollars in international central bank reserves has been decreasing. Now, it's decreasing slowly. It's not going to disappear overnight. But in decades, I think it's quite clear that the hegemony that we've seen of the U.S. dollar dominating the international financial system is over.
Most economies are establishing different mechanisms to circumvent the U.S. sanctions regime and the hegemony of the U.S. dollar. These range from using barter trade to trading in their currencies over the dollar. The world is moving toward multipolarity, and the U.S. is no longer the world's largest trading nation. It's China. Therefore, it's only a matter of time before the U.S. dollar loses its dominance among global currencies.
At least three Israelis were killed and several others injured in the city of Elat on Thursday in an operation the Palestinian resistance groups hailed as a victory for the residents of the occupied Al-Quds. The incident took place on the day of Nakba, or the Day of Catastrophe, marking the anniversary of Israel's eviction of Palestinians from their homeland and declaring its existence.
It was the event when 3/5, 40% of the Palestinian population was expelled or killed or expelled from their homeland, Palestine, and expelled mostly going abroad to neighboring countries and even distant countries.
The operation took place after over 600 Israeli settlers raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound under protection from the regime's forces. Over a dozen Palestinians were injured, and some 50 others, including the elderly and children, were arrested during raid. In a statement, Palestinian resistance movement Hamas stressed that the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds is a red line and that the Elat operation reflects the Palestinian nation's wrath over repeated Israeli desecrations of their holy sites. The Islamic Jihad resistance movement termed the desecration of Al-Aqsa Mosque by Israeli forces and extremist Jewish settlers a declaration of war against the entire Palestinian nation, stating that Palestinians will continue to confront the occupiers and their aggression. The Muslim holy month of Ramadan has practically turned into a period of escalating tensions between Israelis and Palestinians. Israeli forces raids on the Al-Aqsa Mosque culminated in an 11-day war between the regime and Gaza-based resistance groups in May last year, a conflict that killed over 260 Palestinians, including scores of women and children. There has also been a recent surge in the number of Palestinian operations across the occupied territories over the past few weeks, raising fears that another war might be on the cards. The reactions to the mounting tensions have been particularly interesting.
while many Western nations have kept silent about the developments, some, including U.S. President Joe Biden, have been calling on both sides to avoid violence and exercise restraint. A parallel can be drawn with the war in Ukraine. Is anyone calling on Ukrainian troops to lay down their arms?
In a way, it's the same thing that is causing the United States to back the Ukrainians and to be against the Palestinians. The United States sees an advantage and in putting pressure on a potential rival to its power, in this case Russia. They decided that Israel is the power that could help them to achieve that dominance. So it's all about in effect the United States ruling the world.
The normalization of ties between some Arab states and Israel has made matters even worse for the people of Palestine, despite earlier promises that the establishment of relations would benefit their cause. The Palestinians have vowed to continue their resistance until their legitimate rights are acknowledged. If the developments over the past several decades are any indication, they will make good on their words.
The United States is a permanent member of the United Nations Security Council. That title means a lot of responsibility, as every permanent member is expected to remain committed to global security and collective council action. But the U.S. has shown for decades that it is very much ready to take unilateral measures to get what it wants. A case in point is America's sanctions policy. The U.S. has gone outside the U.N. Security Council mechanism to impose tough unilateral sanctions against many countries. Even close U.S. allies may become a target of American sanctions. This is the Harry S. Truman Building in Washington, D.C. It is the headquarters of the United States Department of State. Many major U.S. economic sanctions programs targeting countries around the world are devised and enforced by politicians, diplomats, and lawyers who work here. From coercion and threats to financial punishment, the team does everything to make sure the sanctions are enforced. Perhaps the harshest sanctions ever imposed by the U.S. have targeted Iran, Venezuela, North Korea, and the Russian Federation. America usually defends its sanctions policy, claiming that it is aimed at changing the behavior of foreign governments. But ordinary people in targeted countries have been bearing the brunt of U.S. sanctions.
The United States uses sanctions as a form of hybrid warfare. It is a form of warfare, it's economic warfare, and it's a modern-day version of siege warfare. So you can imagine that the United States, without committing troops on the ground, uses sanctions as a tool in its arsenal for regime change and for pressure campaigns, both politically, militarily, and economically, on countries that do not kowtow to it, do not bow to it, and do not follow Washington's policies.
In Iran, the sanctions have caused economic hardship for people, among other problems. Iranian cancer patients, for instance, have been hit hard by the adverse effects of sanctions. That is because many firms, financial institutions, and banks, which are vital in importing medicine, have been blacklisted by the U.S. State Department. Iran has been targeted by some of the harshest American sanctions in decades. Washington refused to give Tehran any relief, even at the height of the coronavirus pandemic, when all countries needed much more financial resources to battle the disease. Although Iran has many years of experience dealing with such economic restrictions, a considerable part of its problems are being blamed on them. They have put a lot of pressure on Iran's economy, causing its currency to lose value and pushing up its rate of inflation to unprecedented levels over the past years. Iran's UN envoy has called on the world body's Department of Global Communications to intensify its efforts to inform the international community about the adverse effects of sanctions on the targeted countries. Addressing a session of the UN's Committee on Information on Wednesday, Iran's permanent ambassador to the United Nations said the use of the coercive economic measures are contrary to international law, international humanitarian law, and the UN Charter. Majid Takht-Ravanchi noted that the sanctions have undermined economic growth in the target countries and prevent their access to basic medical equipment and materials by blocking their financial resources overseas.
People can't have access to proper medical supplies, food, different types of technologies that are necessary, for example, aviation. You can think of transportation, things like that. Raw materials that are necessary just for basic industry and production. And overall, you see that there is a massive pressure put on the population in terms of their economic power to purchase consumer products because of the sanctions that are imposed. So it puts tremendous pressure on civilian population.
Iran has in the past described American sanctions policy as economic terrorism. Tehran says the U.S. is addicted to such coercive tools. Despite criticism from around the world, the United States does not seem willing to change course anytime soon.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 12th 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic. I could equally mention assembly companies and assemblers. Assembly is actually a kind of unnecessary importation in a different way. This is not production. This is not creating a product. Rather, it is merely a kind of importation. Such companies should not be allowed to register as a knowledge-based company. This is not correct. Therefore, there is a need for defining precise criteria and indicators for these companies. I think that this falls on the Vice Presidency for Science and Technology and the other organization that is in charge of approving these companies. These must take these criteria seriously. Another point is that in order to assess whether the country's production has become knowledge-based or not, merely looking at the number of knowledge-based companies is not enough. In my New Year's speech, I stressed numbers. It was said that such and such a number of companies can be established this year, but I said that there should be more. They said that such companies might increase by 30%, but I said that it should be 50%, at least 50%, but it could be 100% too. Well, this is related to quantity, which is a criterion, but it is not enough.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The companies that are established must have certain characteristics which are vital and fundamental. One of these characteristics is that there must be innovation in them. Another is that they must help reduce foreign currency importation. At the present time, in order to import certain products, we spend hugely. If a knowledge-based company manufactures this product or brings it close to manufacture, this will either reduce the expenditures or it will completely eliminate them. This is one of the criteria. One of the criteria for knowledge-based companies is that they must create employment in the true sense of the word. They must have the capability to export. In other words, they must be competitive in the face of global products. These criteria must be specified and pursued, God willing.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Victory Day is celebrated on May 9th in Russia as one of the most important holidays in the country, as it marks the capitulation of Nazi Germany to the Soviet Union. An estimated 27 million Soviet soldiers and civilians were killed in the Second World War, known in Russia as the Great Patriotic War, or the holiday with tears in the eyes. This year's celebrations come at a time when Russia's relations with the West are at their lowest level. NATO countries openly supply Ukraine with weapons and conduct military exercises along Russian borders. In his speech at the parade, Russian President Vladimir Putin talked about the ongoing attempts in the world to justify the crimes of the Nazis, recalled the actions of NATO in Ukraine, and explained the reasons for the military action in Donbass.
Страна НАТО не захотели нас услышать.
The NATO countries did not want to hear us, which means that in fact they had completely different plans, and we saw it. Openly, preparations were underway for another punitive operation in the Donbas, an invasion of our historical lands, including Crimea.
Putin has defended the offensive against Ukraine, describing it as a preemptive measure.
Кто разгромил нацизм?
We saw how the military infrastructure is being developed, how hundreds of foreign advisors began to work, regular deliveries of the most modern weapons from NATO countries were going on. The danger grew every day. Russia gave a preemptive rebuff to aggression. It was a forced, timely, and only correct decision, the decision of a sovereign, strong, and independent country.
And after the traditional military parade on Red Square, the president led the People's Parade. Starting 2015, the Immortal Regiment Parade is held in hundreds of Russian-inhabited localities from Kaliningrad to Vladivostok and in other countries. It became the most significant emotional event, as there is no family that has remained unaffected in Russia. All who remember and honor their own veterans of the Army and Navy, partisans, resistance fighters, home front combatants, Nazi concentration camp prisoners, come out with a picture of their beloved, those who fought or gave their lives for liberation of the USSR and Europe. In Russia, Victory Day remains the most important public holiday of the year. It is equally revered in many of the former Soviet republics. The Great Patriotic War, which started for the Soviets in 1941, united the entire nation and still remains a centerpiece of Russia's consciousness. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
The Palestinian conflict is the longest-running conflict on record for the United Nations. Multiple attempts at reaching a lasting peace have been and gone. Now, conveners of the Convivencia Initiative have spent years poring over a new document that they hope will become the blueprint for a movement that will push for a just peace for Palestinians.
People forget that for almost 2,000 years, Jews, Christians, and later Muslims lived in total harmony in Palestine. The Jews in Palestine were Palestinians. There was no division, there was no racism, there was no anti-Semitism. All these are European inventions.
The vision of stepping away from violence in Palestine and the region can only work if movements for peace are supported by genuine reconciliation and justice at their heart. Now, this bold new initiative being launched in London is putting true solidarity between Muslims, Christians, and Jews at its foundation and hoping for global success.
The suspicions around interfaith dialogue have also been an obstacle.
It was perhaps the first time I've seen something with a vision for Palestine, bringing together Jews, Muslims, and Christians here in the UK and abroad, working together for justice and peace in Palestine. Because too often, interfaith dialogue is what I call lowest common denominator. I've been involved in activities with Jewish groups where they say, well, we can't talk about Palestine, or we can't talk about the settlements. And therefore, it shuts down genuine conversation about the causes of the justice in Palestine.
Obviously, without justice and equality and freedom for the Palestinians as well as the Jewish Israeli inhabitants of that area, there can never be a proper peace. If there's not peace in the Middle East, we know that unfortunately there are ramifications for the rest of us in all our societies.
With a growing list of supporters, the hope is to spread the spirit of convivencia.
Even a little child understands justice. If we don't stand against injustice and support each other, what's the point of coming together? And this is really a challenge to create a better future for ourselves, for our children, not just in Palestine, but everywhere else.
For far too long, division has defined the ongoing crisis. But this new initiative is forging the path to a united and just solution for Palestine and the world. Amina Taylor, London.
Israel has sold its Pegasus software to dozens of countries around the world, which allows spies to easily hack into mobile phones and retrieve personal data. Apparently, very high-profile individuals have been targeted. Now, the PEGA committee inside the European Parliament has been set up to investigate.
We cannot overemphasize the severity of this scandal. When this kind of spyware is used against innocent citizens, whether they're journalists, activists, lawyers, businessmen or politicians, and regardless where in the European Union or even beyond.
The European Commission has been slated for refusing to take action against Tel Aviv for failing to rein in Israel's NSO company, which produces Pegasus.
This is about the accountability of the European Commission to the European citizens and to the European Parliament. You have a duty to investigate.
EU Commissioner Johannes Hahn told lawmakers it's a matter for national governments.
Mr. Commissioner, if you say it's member states in charge, would you mind telling me which member state is actually in charge of investigating in this and protecting us?
EU countries Poland and Hungary have been heavily criticised for buying the spyware from Israel. But one lawmaker says the bloc turned a blind eye when it was revealed in 2019 that Germany was spying on its allies.
Do not be a hypocrite. Do not point Poland and Hungary. Point everyone. Because who was in charge of German government? Madam Merkel. You were shaking in front of Merkel. Everyone was silent.
There was even a commissioner saying, oh, haha, I have a very boring life. There's nothing on my phone.
Experts say the it's fine, I have nothing to hide argument doesn't hold water.
At the heart of liberalism is saying exactly the contrary. You always need to hide and to have an umbrella against the eye of the state.
The European Parliament's PEGA committee is due to conclude its inquiry in 11 months from now. Already there is a great deal of scepticism that the EU will take any action against Israel regardless of the findings. After all, it has always shied away from doing so in the past. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Days after launching a massive manhunt across the occupied territories, Israeli military forces arrested the two Palestinian youths who carried out Thursday's deadly operation in the settlement of Elad that was established on the Palestinian village of Mzera, central Israel. 19-year-old Asad Arifai and 20-year-old Subh Sbihat were arrested in a forest near Elad. Israeli military forces, Israel's intelligence agency, and Israeli police all took part in the manhunt.
The two heroes were arrested, but we affirm that they carried out a special operation, a move that has made Palestinians feel proud. The Israeli regime mobilized all human, logistical and technological capabilities to arrest the two youths. The Israeli military establishment will try to use their capture and publish the videos of their arrest to cover its security failure. But those two proved that the Israeli security is fragile.
Immediately following Thursday's operation that left three Israeli settlers dead and four others wounded, Israeli military took a number of decisions. First, family members of the two youths, who are from the village of Romani near Jenin in north-occupied West Bank, were arrested and interrogated, in addition to many others close to them. Experts now say the second step would be demolishing their homes as part of the collective punishment Israel imposes in such incidents. Israel urges the move is a deterrence act to force Palestinians to quit resistance. A number of Israeli legislators and experts have promoted for killing senior Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar in response to the current wave of operations, which he has encouraged. Meanwhile, the group's military wing issued a threat for an unprecedented response and a regional earthquake should Israel attempt to harm any of its top leadership, especially Yahya Sinwar.
From day one, it was crystal clear for Palestinians that the two youths would be either arrested or killed by the Israeli forces. Palestinians say what the two have done was part of their legitimate resistance. They add the operation was a heroic move and in retaliation for the Israeli crimes and the settlers' incursions into the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Muna Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
NATO's hopes of securing two new additions to its military alliance are close to becoming reality as the historically neutral Nordic countries, Sweden and Finland, take serious steps towards applying for membership. The Scandinavian powers' interest in joining spiked after Russia's military operation in Ukraine began. Just the idea of a NATO expansion northwards has sparked a furious Russian response.
Both the US and NATO have made abundantly clear that they are very keen to see the two new Nordic additions to the bloc. However, with Sweden and Finland's long history of neutrality seeming to serve them very well until now, is joining the military alliance truly beneficial to their national and regional security?
NATO members, including the UK, US, France and Germany, have been applying pressure to secure the two additions. Moscow has repeatedly warned of serious consequences if Finland and Sweden join NATO, saying it would strengthen its land, naval and air forces in the Baltic Sea and even raise the possibility of deploying nuclear weapons in the area.
But what NATO is doing is to pull increasing numbers of countries within its orbit, either as direct members or as associate members, and that this then ties them to a whole number of things which they may not want to do in the future. The consequences of the end of this neutrality will not be more safety for any country in Eastern Europe. It will be an increase in the arms race on both sides. It will be an increase in military presence in those countries and elsewhere. So this is a road that people should think very, very carefully before they go down.
The coming days are crucial. Finland will decide to apply for membership by May the 12th, while Sweden, the less enthusiastic of the two, is conducting a security policy review, including the pros and cons of joining the alliance. The results are due on May the 13th. If both decide yes, the process of joining will be swift, but so too could Russia's response. Robert Carter, Stockholm.
French President Emmanuel Macron was inaugurated for his second term in a bitterly divided France. With a major portion of his voters aiming to block the far-right's Marine Le Pen, again, analysts say the first president to be re-elected in 20 years still lacks a broad mandate for more far-right economic policies. The Yellow Vests marched nationwide to send the message that they will not be intimidated or stop demanding more public opinion in public policies.
No, I'm never giving up, no. I've not been doing this for 3.5 years just so I can stop tomorrow. No way, no, no. Either we win or I die and these guys will carry on. People should never stop. They should keep going, keep going, keep going. Because this is what the governments are hoping. All governments are hoping that people give up and just let them do their thing.
The French left has put aside their squabbles and joined in a united coalition for the first time since 1936. Their goal is to prevent Macron and other conservatives from allying in another absolute majority in June's parliamentary elections. The left coalition hopes to force more compromise from a president long referred to as a liberal strongman.
Macron simply must not have a legislative majority again. The last 5 years were such a catastrophe. I hope the French people join us in the streets again because the prices of products are shamefully high, even products which are totally produced in France.
Macron's speech acknowledged the nation's disunity and said his key priorities will be the environment, the unrest in Ukraine, and European stability. The pan-European project continues to be plagued by perceptions of democratic illegitimacy and constantly rising economic inequality. A belligerent policy towards Russia may turn the Eurozone's ongoing lost decade into a lost score.
Macron's second term begins with unrest abroad, and if his first term is any guide, constant social unrest at home. pitched social battles between Macron's far-right economic plans and a French populace unconvinced by economic austerity are expected to begin no later than this autumn. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
It's a warm welcome for an end to frosty ties. It's the second time in almost 3 years that Polish Foreign Minister Zbigniew Rau has visited Iran. His two-day trip began with a meeting with his Iranian counterpart, Hossein Amir Abdollahian. The talks were held behind closed doors, while the two diplomats briefed reporters on the themes of the discussions, which ranged from economic ties to the Russo-Ukrainian war.
We talked on important issues today, on potentials for economic cooperation. We also spoke about the Russian-Ukrainian conflict. I should thank Poland for hosting Ukrainian refugees in the Russian-Ukrainian war. Iran, for its part, has since day one called for a political solution to the crisis.
The Polish diplomat's trip comes on the 80th anniversary of the entry of Polish refugees into Iran during the thick of World War II. In 1942, Iran was a major landing point for some 120,000 Polish refugees who were forced out of Poland by the Soviet Union. Touching on the issue, the top Polish diplomat said Iran's hospitality created a cordial relationship between the two nations.
We are making the 80th anniversary of the exodus of Polish refugees from their land by the USSR. I should once again thank the Iranian nation who has hosted our countrymen, providing a safe haven for them for decades.
The Polish foreign minister underlined the significance of the 2015 deal in bringing peace, calling on both Iranian and American officials to arrive at an agreement as soon as possible.
Poland and Iran are looking forward to the success of the negotiations over the 2015 deal. When that happens, we will start extensive economic cooperation with Iran without worries over the sanctions.
Poland sits on a geostrategically important part of Eastern Europe. It could act as a gateway for Iran to trade with other European states. Iran, for its part, can also act as a gateway for Polish trade with the Middle East. The two sides cited lack of knowledge as the main reason behind their low trade, hoping that this trip will set the start for broader economic ties.
After decades of uneventful relations, Tehran and Warsaw are now determined to begin a new chapter in their ties. And this last visit by the Polish foreign minister is seen as the first step towards stronger ties between the two countries, something which could redefine the course of many unresolved issues, from the fate of the 2015 deal to Iran's ties with the West. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rohingya refugees in India are in a desperate situation following renewed detention and deportation campaigns from the administration. Schools have already been detained while some deported. Intense crackdown on the community has created fear, which has led to sleepless nights amid worries of night raids and family separations. This old man, a little familiar with the local language, says, "I don't go out of the camp and prefer dying here than in a detention camp." Thousands of Rohingya refugees in India are living in an appalling situation with little or no help from anyone. Even the UN Refugee Agency is watching as a silent spectator, they said. Their men were involved in menial work for survival. However, due to detention fear, they had no choice but to abandon work and stick together in their camps.
Finding this camp wasn't easy, and upon reaching here, panic and horror was visible on every face. They got terrified upon seeing us and rushed to hidings, saying media in India is portraying their image very negatively, and this has made their survival even harder. According to rights activists, refugee crises across the world are alarming, but this particular community continues to be an unseen victim of immeasurable extents of violence. Based on official estimates, more than 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living in parts of India after fleeing a brutal crackdown against their community in Myanmar. Many refugees say they felt safe in India since they arrived, but over the last few years, a vicious hate campaign and their expulsion is haunting the community.
We appeal to the UN. We have no support. We need your help and the help from the Indian government to stay alive. We are in acute pain and distress. We reached here just with our lives intact. Please do not detain us, deport us, or separate us from families. Rather kill us. We have no strength to face more.
Activists say the need of the hour is to protect the rights of these refugees and secure their survival, rather than deliberately targeting them and deporting them, despite the fact their lives are under threat back in Myanmar. Rights activists have urged the Indian government to formulate a uniform refugee policy. Since the country has no refugee law, they urge the Indian government to treat refugees equally, regardless of caste, ethnicity, or faith.